Thank you very much. I'm much more comfortable, excuse me, being an Uber driver, which is what I've been doing and what I was doing when I wrote this in Pittsburgh. And when I would drive people around, inevitably they'd say, well, what do you really do for a living? And I'd say, I write books. And they'd say, what kind of book? Books or book? And I'd start to tell them about 30 Days of Black Man. And the Uber version of the book is that Pittsburgh's greatest journalist, Ray Spriggle, who worked at the Post-Gazette from about 1911 to 1957, was a total superstar. I always tell people, if he had worked in New York or LA, Spencer Tracy would have played him in a movie in 1950. He three times in his life made national news, literally. And in those days, daily newspapers were the big media of the day, from 1911 to 1948 even. In 1938, he went down to Birmingham, Alabama, and dug up the paperwork that proved that Justice Hugo Black, newly nominated and confirmed to the Supreme Court by FDR, had indeed been a member, a very faithful member of the KKK in Alabama, which I guess if you wanted to be dog catcher, you had to make friends with the KKK in Alabama in those years. Spriggle's stories were literally on every newspaper in the country. It was the biggest news story of 1937, which is kind of hard to believe, but I guess it was. In 38, they gave him a Pulitzer Prize for that. In 1945, Spriggle pretended to be a black market butcher in Pittsburgh, and he went out. The pictures, it's easier with slides because it's hard to believe. He disguised himself. He took out his false teeth, bought a stupid little 99-cent hat, rented an old truck, and drove around Pittsburgh, mainly up and down Route 19 in the south, and bought more than a ton of meat on the black market without ration coupons and everything else. And he was, again, national headlines. Federal government sent hearings here. They pulled him up on the stand, and he said, I'm not going to tell you anything more. Everything I know is in my next five or six part, everything he wrote was five, six part series. Later on, he also went undercover many times, once as a coal miner in 1928 for like 7 or 8 days. He got hired on as a coal miner. He was in his early 40s, came out and wrote a six part series, page ones for the Post-Gazette. In 1931, he went into Mayview State Mental Hospital as a homeless type patient, came out and wrote what I think is his best series. Again, five or six parts, page one, shockingly detailed, tremendous writer. He was a Pulp Fiction writer in his youth. And then he went into journalism. So he knew how to write well, as a fiction writer does. He loved crime and criminals and that whole underworld scene as a kid. And it's hard to believe what a superstar he is. I always say, if I had read half of what I had to read to do this book, about the things that he wrote for the Post-Gazette, I would have become a plumber or a lawyer, because I would have said, you know, there's no way you can compete with this guy. So in 48, he decided, at the time, 1948, this country was highly segregated, as some of us know better than others. And he, in 1948, he decided the only way he's going to find out what life is really like for the 10 million black people, of the 14 million blacks still in the country, 10 million still lived in the South, despite the great migration that was occurring. There were about 150 million Americans, 10% were black. Most of those still lived in the South under Jim Crow, legal segregation, I think 17 states or something, from Virginia to Texas. And he said the only way he's going to find out what it's like for those people is to pretend to be a black person and live like one for 30 days in the South. He approached the NAACP, Walter White, National Executive Secretary, another superstar guy who we've sort of forgotten. He loved the idea because he knew who Spriggle was. He knew Spriggle would do a great story. Spriggle was already famous. They knew what would happen if he did a big story like he planned. Spriggle first tried to dye his skin with various substances, mahogany bark and walnut juice and some chemicals that probably would have killed him. And Walter White, and a friend of his said, just Walter White, who was probably whiter than I am, because I have a pretty good tan from golfing, said, don't worry about your skin color. You just go get a heavy tan in the South, and if you say you're black in the South, no one's going to argue with you. You know? And so that's what Spriggle did. He just got a heavy tan in Florida, and he met his guide, who was handpicked by Walter White and his friends. And his guide was a guy named John Wesley Dobbs, another superstar from Atlanta, grandfather of Maynard Jackson, the first black mayor, father of six Spelman graduates, six girls, all graduates of Spelman, which was the black Vassar, they used to call it, I guess. He quoted Shakespeare. He quoted the books on Lincoln, Napoleon. He had memorized 500 poems, this John Wesley Dobbs, whose grandfather was a white slave master, as most people of his generation had some kind of connection with the slave owners. Anyway, 1948, the United States was effectively a segregated country, either by law in the South or by fact in the North and West. In every city and town, blacks had their own neighborhoods, commercial districts, and social institutions. They ran their own newspapers, magazines, radio stations, and numbers rackets. They produced their own race movies and race records and formed their own professional baseball leagues. They had their own colleges, churches, labor unions, fraternal groups, hospitals, cemeteries, restaurants, life insurance companies, bars, parks, YMCAs, swimming pools, jazz joints, funeral parlors, taxi cabs, doctors, dentists, and even police. And I'm sorry, I can't. I'm not used to reading. In 1948, the United States was the richest and most powerful country on the planet. However, black Americans were not sharing equally in the country's post-war prosperity. They were disproportionately poor, undereducated, and discriminated against in both the rural South and the urban North. America was where a colorblind constitution and the rule of law were supposed to guarantee every individual the right to live, speak, worship, work, vote, and travel freely, where your property rights were protected, and where no matter how rich or poor you were, you had the right to peacefully pursue your own happiness without fear from your government or neighbors. In reality, America had yet to live up to its founding principles and ideals for many of its people. Women, homosexuals, Latinos, Jews, and American Indians still had steep uphill legal roads to travel before they became free and equal citizens. And for 14 million blacks, 1 in 10 Americans, the land of the free was more like an extension of the feudal Mississippi Delta. From Boston to Atlanta to Los Angeles, virtually everything of importance or great value in government, business, education, and entertainment was owned and operated by white people, white men mostly. Interracial marriage was against the law in every state of the South and would technically stay that way until the restriction was declared unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1967. In the North, blacks in cities like Pittsburgh were subjected to a range of blatant and subtle extra-legal discriminations and social indignities in employment, in housing, and in their daily lives. They too had fewer and steeper paths to achieving the American dream. But at least in the North, they were equal to whites under the law. In the Jim Crow South, 83 years after the end of the Civil War, it was the law itself that hurt blacks and made certain they stayed third-class citizens in their own country. That's where Spriggle was headed, into the South. And the North was not the greatest place either. But Spriggle worked at the Post-Gazette, and he lived out by the airport in Moon on a farm. Not much of a farm, a hobby farm, really. And he would come into town every day and work at the Post-Gazette. And he was 61 years old at this time when he went south in his disguise. He was 61. His guy, John Wesley Dobbs, was 66. And this is a sort of a typical day for Spriggle. Except for the, excuse me, except for his clandestine afternoon meeting with the NAACP's Walter White, Spriggle's agenda on September 25th, 1947, was that of a typical Thursday. At 10 a.m., he drove into Coraopolis, parked his car at a gas station, and rode the bus downtown to the Post-Gazette building. Because the PG was a morning paper, most of the writing was done in late afternoon and into the evening. Just like in the old movies, the newsroom was a dirty, noisy, unhealthy, but democratic workplace for men. Only the publisher and editor had private offices. Phones rang. Teletype machines and typewriters banged against cheap paper. Everyone smoked something. The smell of printer's ink and hot lead hung in the air. Many of the men had half a whiskey bottle in their desk drawer. Spriggle's oak desk sat in an open room of equally messy desks. Sprigg was the star and usually the center of attention. Everyone who worked with him liked him. He was good-natured. He was one of the boys, a reporter, not an editor. He was just older, wiser, better dressed, and far better paid. Spriggle's voice boomed. His pipe fumed. He joked. He cursed. Everyone did. It was a newspaper office. His desk was cluttered with old newspapers, wire baskets, thick pencils, a can of Granger pipe tobacco, a phone. Years of yellowed copy paper were impaled on a deadly spike. Typewriters were shared by reporters, but Spriggle had his own. It was borrowed so often, he had to get tough and attach a warning. This is my typewriter, bought and paid for with my own money, so keep your goddamn hands off it. And that's, so that's Mr. Spriggle, that's what he was like. He was actually a very wonderful man in many ways. And I tried to find something that brought him down to a more human level, but I couldn't. And his daughter, Ray Jean Spriggle, who's 81 and became a professor of intellectual medieval history at CMU for a while and other places, is still alive and well, and she remembers everything. She loved, she was the only child born late and loved her father to death and knows everything about him, everything. She used to go down to work with him, and she knew, she was obviously indispensable in this, with this. You okay? You want some water? You know, okay. I forgot, since this is has to do with poetry, which you guys all read so well and did so well and know so well. I started chapter 11. I tried to get the whole, I tried to get the rights to the whole poem, but it would have cost me God knows how much money, and they make it so hard. You know, you're better just to take fair use, just steal a little. And if they want to come and sue me, you know, and they say you used too much of Langston Hughes's poem, then they can do so, and they can try to get, you know, blood from a stone, as they say, I guess. But anyway, I started chapter 11, sneaking through the Delta. That's the Mississippi Delta, with a Langston Hughes poem called Sharecroppers, and it was pretty simple, but I just stumbled upon it, and so I said, oh, this is perfect, you know, obviously perfect. And the chapter starts, year by year goes by, and we are nothing more than a herd of Negroes driven to the field, plowing life away to make the cotton yield. And it goes on and on, but that was Langston Hughes's impression of the 500,000 sharecroppers who worked the cotton fields in the Delta in 1948. And anyway. You okay? Dobbs drove Spriggle around. Dobbs had a beautiful house in Atlanta around the corner from some young man named Martin Luther King Jr. And he lived in the black neighborhood of Atlanta, which then and probably still now is considered the wealthiest black neighborhood in America. Maybe Harlem, parts of Harlem was. But Dobbs was called the mayor of Auburn Avenue being the main strip of the black, or Sweet Auburn, right? And again, Dobbs was beyond belief. But so he drove Spriggle around. He hosted him. He let Spriggle stay at his house. And then they drove out to Savannah one time. They drove into South Georgia, into the peach and cotton fields. And then they drove through the Delta on three different trips over a course of a month. And Spriggle interviewed, it must have been 100 or 200 people. He met everybody, sharecroppers to professors to doctors and funeral directors and leaders in various towns. Dobbs knew them all because he was the grand master of the Prince Hall Masons of Georgia, which the Prince Hall Masons are the equivalent of the white Masons. White Masons wouldn't let blacks in, so they formed their own. And so Dobbs had power and clout and money and influence because of that job. And he was also a political and social leader in Atlanta. Anyway, Spriggle and Dobbs pushed north on Highway 61, this is in Mississippi, in their big Mercury. If there hadn't been telephone wires strung along the road and Pepsi-Cola signs nailed to the fronts of the few colored cafes and general stores they passed, it could have been 1880. The brown fields on both sides of the two-lane highway were scattered to the horizons with ragged little columns of men, women, and children in overalls, printed cotton dresses, and wide straw hats, sharecroppers. All of them were black. Some were in their 70s, some as young as 5. Heads bowed, eyes to the ground, they mechanically worked their long hoes in short chops as they moved among the rows of baby cotton plants that they would tend until picking time in the fall. 500,000 black Americans lived in the Delta. Most were sharecroppers, day laborers, and tenant farmers. They and their large families lived in unpainted shotgun shacks that were on plantations as large as 20,000 acres or that were scattered randomly among the dirt and gravel roads. Tenant farmers who grew their own cotton on 10 acres of rented land worked 12-hour days, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. Sharecroppers who paid their rent by giving their landlord about 30% of their crops often worked longer, from dawn to dusk. Using tools, animals, fertilizer, seeds, and food they bought from the landlord's store on credit, the sharecroppers and tenant farmers raised cotton from seed to bale. Like their parents, sharecroppers lived in shacks, walked behind one mule plows, weeded cotton rows with hoes, and handpicked 100 pounds of cotton bolls a day under the baking Mississippi sun. Unlike their grandparents, they were not slaves, but they were close to it. In the most advanced country on earth, 3 years into the atomic age, they were 19th century poor. They had no electricity, no running water, no property, no assets, no savings, no access to credit, no vote, no future in the Jim Crow Mississippi for themselves or their children. 15 miles west of Spriggle and Dobbs were the sharp bends and coils of the sleeping Mississippi River, which, along with the levees that had tamed it, formed the state's crinkled western edge. For thousands of years, its floods and the floods of its equally erratic junior partner, the Yazoo, had laid down the Delta's deep alluvial plain, an oval 200 miles tall by 70 miles wide in northwest Mississippi. The Delta stands like a teardrop between Memphis and Vicksburg. Flat as a griddle and spectacularly fertile, it's a perfect blend of climate and soil. The richest land this side of the Valley Nile is how plantation owner Big Daddy Pollitt described it, without exaggerating, in Tennessee Williams' play Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. When Spriggle came back from his trip, he wrote a 21-part series for the Post-Gazette. It was syndicated in about 15 papers around the country. It ran for 21 straight days on page one. And Spriggle had disappeared from the Post-Gazette's pages. And he was almost like an every other day presence. His iconic photo of him in this goofy Stetson hat and his corncob pipe must have run thousands of times in the Post-Gazette. He was a true media celebrity, the only celebrity in Pittsburgh. Drunks and the governor of the state recognized him on site, and he was friends with the governor. But when he came back, his first article, all of a sudden, there he was on the front page, and the pictures are in the book of him in his disguise, which he posed for after he got back, but and he doesn't look like Ray Spriggle, the iconic figure. That's anyway. Spriggle's byline had disappeared from the Post-Gazette without explanation for 4.5 months. In the first paragraph of a series, he summed up where he had been. And this is what he wrote. For 4 endless crawling weeks, I was a Negro in the Deep South. I ate, slept, traveled, lived black. I lodged in Negro households. I ate in Negro restaurants. I slept in Negro hotels and lodging houses. I crept through the back and side doors of railroad stations. I traveled Jim Crow in buses and trains and streetcars and taxicabs. Along with 10 million Negroes, I endured the discrimination and oppression and cruelty of the iniquitous Jim Crow system. It was a typical Spriggle production, a strong opening, lots of colorful writing with strong opinions, and a generous sprinkling of sarcasm and hyperbole. Objectivity was neither practiced nor feigned, sounding a moral tone reminiscent of an old-style muckraking magazine writer. He woke up 300,000 Post-Gazette readers with the opening installment of a detailed, impassioned, and frequently bitter inside look at a part of America few of them knew or cared anything about. Along with exposing the petty workings of Jim Crow, he described what it felt like to know that, quote, your rights of citizenship ran only as far as the nearest white man said they did. Spriggle's series created quite a stir in the country for about 3 or 4 months. For the first time, a major white paper in the North was talking about and debating ending legal segregation in the South. It just was not talked about. White papers wrote about white things for white people. Black papers like the Pittsburgh Courier, which at the time had 400,000 subscribers, it now has 4,000, was one of the most important black papers in the country, a weekly, as most black papers were. And the Courier and the Chicago Defender wrote constantly about the South and the black problems there and in the North, but about lynchings and the trials that followed lynchings and the voting suppression and all that, on and on and on. They wrote about it constantly. White papers. You can search the Post-Gazette and the Courier with newspapers.com. And it's probably not foolproof, but it's good enough for journalism, right? I searched for the term NAACP in the Post-Gazette. I think it came up like 6 times for the year of 1947 or 48. I mean, that's how they just didn't. I mean, it wasn't because they were all racist or evil people. It's just the way it was at that time. Black papers, white papers, and black people had to read white papers because that was the main source of news. If you wanted to know what was going on in the Arab-Israeli War in 1948, which started just as Spriggle was embarking on his road trip, you picked up the daily paper. They had the map. You can see the maps and all the details of the Arabs attacking and all this stuff. There was no TV in 1948. So it was, the big media was daily newspapers and network radio, but network radio was not that big. But so Spriggle started a national debate about segregation. And what he did was, he shocked the North, the white North, who knew nothing about anything that was going on in the South. He pissed off the white South, and especially the editors of the newspapers, his fellow newspaper people who just didn't want a Yankee coming down and telling them what they should or shouldn't do about, you know, segregation and, or black-white issues. And he started this national debate. Spriggle's, you know, the spurt of debate in the media about ending legal segregation ended with a national radio debate a couple days after Truman, you know, in a big upset, beat Dewey. Dewey, by the way, was a total liberal. He was like the most liberal, most progressive politician in the country in terms of race relations. New York was the model. Everybody wanted, you know, other states to follow the New York model, and other people said that blacks were treated better in New York State than in any other state and all this stuff. But that didn't, I mean, that wasn't even an issue. But that ironically, that's what, who lost. Another ironic is that Truman was in the process of becoming the first civil rights president with some speeches and desegregating the armed forces and things like that. Anyway, they had a national debate on TV. Ray Spriggle, Walter White, and two white superstar white journalists, Hodding Carter II, Jr., not the one who worked for President Carter, but his father, and another guy, Harry Ashmore, who would win a Pulitzer in 1957 for his coverage of the Little Rock Central High School desegregation. So the four of them debated for an hour on town hall meeting of the air. And it was like the 500th show in this public affairs program. Went out to 200 and some stations. A total audience of 10 million could have heard it. No one knows how many really did hear it. They argued for an hour on this formerly taboo in network radio, the taboo subject of segregation. And Spriggle, from what he wrote, we know he knew what to do with words and how to argue and how to think on his feet and everything else too. Just to give you an idea how he operated, he was given it was an hour show, primetime radio, Tuesday night. All over the country, NAACP branches were holding, listening parties, and all the major black leaders at that time were listening. This was a big deal. Bigger than I guess we could ever imagine. Today, everything seems like such a big deal. Spriggle was up first. He didn't beat around the bush or dial back his "I was a Negro in the South for 30 days" rhetoric. That was the title of his Post-Gazette series, which is a little kind of clunky, but it at least it tells you what he was doing. So Mr. Denny was the moderator of the show. "Mr. Denny, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to get one thing clear at the start. When I talk about race segregation, I insist upon doing so from the standpoint of the Southern Negro leaders who welcomed me into their homes and with whom I lived and traveled for 4 weeks as a Negro myself. To the Southern Negro, segregation is not merely the enforced separation of the races in hotels and restaurants and the like. It is the whole vicious and evil fabric of discrimination, oppression, cruelty, exploitation, denial of simple justice, denial of the rights to full citizenship, and the right to an education, which the white South imposes upon the Negro." So that was like his, he just like gave it a pretty good hit. And at the end, Spriggle denounced murder, quote, "wanton, inexcusable, capricious murder that walk the streets and highways of the Southland, dogging the heels of 10 million black men, and women too, and pouncing whimsically with or without provocation." Then he argued for equal voting rights for blacks, and this is what he said exactly. He said, "What about the right of franchise? Either the Negro, that means all Negroes, is a citizen of the United States, or he isn't. The Constitution and the Supreme Court say that he is. Thousands of heroic Negro dead, sown broadcast over the seven seas in the far corners of the world, who died in the uniforms of the armies and fleets of the Republic and lie with their bodies wrapped in the flag for which they died. These dead men say the Negro is a citizen." So Spriggle was pretty cool. And he said the right thing at the right time, and he said it on his feet. And in one case during the debate, I have a piece of paper where he wrote a little argument down, and it was, any one of us would have liked to have written it after an hour's worth of, contemplation, and he put it out. And then he died in 1957 at 10th and Penn downtown. He went to do another story. He was 71. He was getting a little sickly. He was in a cab. It got hit broadside. Spun him around, and eight hours later, he died at Allegheny General. Mr. Dobbs, his friend, though they didn't apparently keep in contact much after the fact, died on the first on the Monday of the week that Atlanta's schools were integrated for the first time. And Dobbs was the old generation. He was never, he didn't believe in protest marches like his friend Martin Luther King did, and there was always a little tension there, though he did march at the end of his life. Anyway, lots of great people in my book, and it's history, and, you know, we need to always remember our history because it helps us today. Stuff we've forgotten is stuff that we need to know today. So that's it. Sorry. Thank you. Thanks for coming, too, by the way, and thanks to Joan for having me.